Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you download us from. Thank you very much for doing so. Do tell your friends about us. Whether you like us or not, rate us. Our guest today, this is 1187B, and as you know, the bees are always wonderful guests. Today promises to be no exception. Gary Tobbs is the author of 6 books, including the bestsellers Good Calories, Bad Calories, and also Why We Get Fat. You can find his work at GaryTobbs.com. He's a former staff writer for Discover and correspondent for Science, and his writing has appeared on the cover of the New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, Esquire, and numerous best of anthologies, including the best of the best America science writing. He's received 3 Science and Society Awards from the National Association of Science Writers and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Investigator Award in Health Policy Research. Gary, thank you for coming on. We are sponsored by LifesFirstNaturals.com, the makers of both TruBiotics and Bovine Colostrum. You can see the randomized double-blind studies on their website, LifesFirstNaturals.com, and our own website, LongevityPlaybook.com, where you can sign up for the free newsletter with the latest research in longevity. Gary, the book Rethinking Diabetes, as I said, is right in your wheelhouse in the sensational books you've written called Good Calories, Bad Calories, and Why We Get Fat. One of the things that I spend a lot of time doing when I'm with a patient who's a diabetic or even not a diabetic but is overweight is working on trying to find their motivation and working with that to try and get them to both be more physically active, to change their diet to a healthier diet, and manage stress better as well. And part of the reason I think that you wrote this book was to alert doctors to the fact they shouldn't just accept the fact that patients will not change diets. Tell me why you wrote the book, first of all.
Well, as you know, Mike, I've been involved in this writing about nutrition and critically for the past going on 25 years. In this case, there were some obvious questions. When you're looking at diabetes and the history of diabetes, there are some points in the history where you just, if you think about it without any preconceptions, it seems kind of irrational, the decisions that the medical community made. In this case, beginning in 1971, just to give you an example, the American Diabetes Association starts counseling patients with diabetes to get more than 50% of their calories from the one macronutrient, carbohydrates, that they cannot metabolize safely without pharmaceutical assistance. Just from that point onward, as an investigative journalist, reasonable to say, how did we get here? Why is that considered good advice? And to give you an example, I was interviewing a patient, a gentleman who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was 36 years old. He was a chef who became a journalist. And when when you're diagnosed, you're just thrown into this world of the disease and you have no preconceptions whatsoever. And the physician explains to him that he now has this very serious disorder in which he can no longer metabolize the carbohydrates in his diet safely. And so what they're going to do is they're going to give him insulin therapy to control his blood sugar. And then he's going to get half his calories from carbohydrates to make sure he doesn't get low blood sugar or hypoglycemia, it's called, which can be fatal. And he says to the doctor, again, without any preconceptions, let me understand this. What you're telling me is that carbohydrates are now toxic to me now, and insulin, in effect, is the antidote, and you want me to eat the toxin and take the antidote. Why don't I just not eat the toxin. You know, need minimal drug therapy. And the doctor, of course, wants him to be healthy and doesn't want him to have to restrict his diet, doesn't believe that people ever successfully really do that. So that's the advice given. When I wrote this book, and you know, I started my career as an investigative science journalist, but I've become, in effect, a medical historian along the way. I wanted to go back in time to see how this thinking developed, where diet therapy is always considered integral to disease control, but nonetheless takes a backseat to drug therapy in both type 2 diabetes and type 1, and whether that was ever really rigorously tested, and how these assumptions sort of settled in as medical principles, and whether they were justified. Yeah, from the title of the book, Rethinking Diabetes, and you know my history, it's reasonable to assume that I'm going to conclude that they weren't.
Let me go in and explain, I think, how this happened from the medical standpoint, and then get your reaction. And so when we talk to patients about changing diet, being physically active, managing stress, avoiding what we call the unforced errors of vaping and smoking, et cetera, it's pretty easy to understand from the patient's standpoint the physical activity and muscle accumulating fat and diabetes as one of the early signs, and to try and do exercise to help retard that. It's also pretty easy for them to monitor that. It's also been pretty easy for them to learn stress management and to understand a little bit about that and to do that. And because it only takes 6 minutes or so a day. And whether they quit smoking or vaping or not, it is pretty easy to understand that. When we start talking to them about carbohydrates and simple carbohydrates, we feel we are battling the food industry, and especially the fast food and processed food industry, which has created enough flavors and enough easy, inexpensive food that the people most needing it, that is the people who are overweight and diabetic, have a really tough time both understanding and changing that. And until recently, we weren't helped by insurance companies reimbursing counseling for nutrition, except one time for a diabetic. So part of it, I think, isn't just that the American Diabetes Association or the American Heart Association said, let them eat what they're currently eating. We did that, I think, because we were pushed by, if you will, the industries of fast food, especially since the early 1960s, and of processed food, to almost a battle we have with them all the time. Comment on that, would you?
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that level, but I also think that, again, looking at this historically, so until 1921, until the discovery of insulin, the only lever you could pull to get people to control blood sugar once they've been diagnosed with diabetes was a dietary lever. And in fact, the standard of care in the United States, in England, and in Europe, Germany, France, Italy, was what they called back then the animal diet. It was basically, the thinking was these people cannot safely metabolize in carbohydrates, the starches and grains and fruits and sweets in the diet, so they shouldn't eat them, and they can be perfectly healthy and live on, in effect, animal products and green leafy vegetables. What with the discovery of insulin in 1921, suddenly there's a drug therapy, and even more critical, it's a drug therapy that's very powerful at lowering blood sugar. So now they go from telling patients not to eat these foods with varying amount of success to you have to eat carbohydrates because otherwise you have to balance this otherwise this drug we're giving you is going to kill you because it's going to drop your blood sugar too low. And over the next 20 to 30 to 40 years, physicians decide that it's just easier and easier to let the patients eat the carbohydrates in their diet, to eat just like their friends and families, even though they have this very serious chronic disorder, or actually two different versions of it, depending on patient. And that we can cover the symptoms. We can reverse the symptoms of eating these foods with our drug therapy, with insulin and then oral hypoglycemic agents. And now we have these wonderful new GLP-1 agonists like Ozempic and Wegovy. And the assumption all the way through was that patients simply, it's too hard to get patients to follow a diet. They don't want to restrict their foods. They don't want to eat any differently than friends and families. And particularly with children, the diagnosis of type 1 diabetes is so severe, so burdensome, that you don't want to burden them more by making them have, forcing them to eat differently than other people, forcing them to give up the sweets and the ice cream and cake on birthdays and like that. All that would be fine if we knew that it minimized long-term disease risk as well. But throughout this period, and even you know this today, diabetes type 2 and type 1 are considered chronic progressive conditions that are only going to get worse. And that one of the challenges to successful therapy, according to an ADA analysis I read from a few years back, is the resistance of physicians to keep trying new drugs, increasing doses. And even then you have this inevitability of these diabetic complications, heart disease, increased risk of heart disease and stroke, of dementia, nerve damage that leads to amputation and gangrene and lower limb amputation, blindness. All of these things are long-term complications of a disease that might not exist if you can convince the patients to eat differently. And if the patients knew that they had a choice between eating the way they always did and eventually suffering these long-term consequences of poorly, relatively poorly controlled diabetes, or just changing their diet, you might find that they choose a dietary therapy. That's why, after I've discussed this history at great length in the book, basically what I'm saying at the end is there are two ways to handle this disease. One is a relatively strict dietary approach, and the other is a relatively loose dietary approach and drug therapy. And we know that the loose dietary approach and drug therapy does not make people healthy. It just slows the progression to all these pretty burdensome, pretty terrible consequences.
I think you have done a magnificent job on the history of this. And what I want to put in is the caveat that I think it is, in the world we live in, I work tirelessly to get patients to do physical activity, change behavior, and change diet with that as well, and manage stress. And I have the luxury that most physicians don't have of having enough time to try and find out the patient's motivation and to play on that week after week or month after month to get them to understand this. But even so, it is, until at least recently, it has been tough. And now we're beginning to get, we can see at the clinic in our practice, literally we reverse pre-diabetes and early diabetes 60% of the time through diet, exercise, and other lifestyle choices. But there is a group that really has benefited from some of the, for the GLP and GIP drugs. And I want to point that out. In other words, there's a group of patients, and I don't know whether it's 15% or 25%, but it clearly is in that range of people who think about food 24/7. They're planning their next meal and worried and planning it or thinking about it every minute as soon as they finish their last one. And for them, the GLP and GIPs has been revolutionary because they don't think about food, and consequently, they're able to eat a much healthier diet. Now, we don't know the long-term complications of those drugs. You point that out incredibly well in the book. But at least in the short term, it has changed the management of that group of patients, including the diabetics with who just think constantly about food, to being able to really much more easily control their diet and do physical activity and thus reverse their type 2 diabetes. Obviously, that doesn't do anything for type 1.
I completely agree with you. These are remarkable drugs we have now, but, and this is where the history of where the diabetes story comes into it again, and it makes me nervous. I don't even like, really, I'm just finished the draft of an essay that I'm writing about this, and it makes me nervous even saying this, but type 1 diabetes, well, diabetes in general, when insulin was discovered in 1921, it was it's a miracle drug. I mean, they give it to these children who are on the very brink of death. I mean, who you could expect to be dead within days to weeks, and it would bring them back to life and to health. The doctors were stunned by how extraordinary the recoveries were. They talked about it like resurrections, and insulin therapy very quickly spread throughout the diabetes world so that it was used both very appropriately on type 1 diabetes and perhaps very inappropriately on 90 to 95% of the cases with type 2 diabetes. Within about 10 years, they started to see this wave of diabetic complications, again, of the arteriosclerosis, so atherosclerosis, but throughout all the veins and arteries in the body, and neuropathies, amputations, blindness, kidney failure, and these young children who had been saved from death, and let's say 9 or 10 or 12 years old, now were dying of the complications of living with this disease, and what they couldn't know for sure, and we still don't, perhaps the consequences of insulin therapy and the dietary philosophy, they were dying tragically still young in their 20s. And it's hard to imagine that kind of wave of complications coming from the explosion of use in GLP-1 agonists. I mean, we're much more sophisticated today in how we test these drugs in animals and in preliminary efficacy studies. But we're going to have people who are on these drugs for 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and we have no idea what the long-term consequences are, and we have no idea what the consequences of having to go off these drugs are. And we've seen these issues before with, for instance, benzodiazepine use for anxiety and insomnia, or the opioid epidemic is a classic example. We just, bad things happen when we medicate conditions that might be handled without medication, and that might be handled without medication encompasses a universe of hard work and correct dietary information, and it's not easy, and on that we all agree. But I do get nervous that the diseases that we handle, that we treat the symptoms with drugs, that the underlying mechanism remains at work, and that the combination of the consequences of living with that mechanism and living with the complications and the side effects of the drug therapy will eventually make people regret that they started. And maybe only a small percentage, but we have to be aware of that too.
And by the way, as you can tell, Gary Tobbs's book, Rethinking Diabetes, has made me think a great deal about this. And as Gary can probably tell, I've read a great deal of the book, as I feel, one, it's incredibly well written, and two, incredibly well documented. But let me take the other point of view, Gary, and have you, and by the way, you do have a Substack column now. What's the column called?
It's called Unsettled Science, and I'm doing it with my journalistic colleague, Nina Teicholz.
And so, if you will, it is Unsettled Science on Substack, as well as you can go to GaryTobbs.com. Gary, most of the type 1 diabetics died in the old days, and although diet could get them to live a little longer, it wasn't any place near as long as insulin was able to. Similarly, diet can help with cholesterol management, but we now have powerful drugs that help us with this, in addition to diet, exercise, stress management, etc. And so I think what I don't want people to get is the thought that we should be total drug nihilists, because these have major advances. I think the point of type 2 diabetes, avoiding insulin and managing it the way you suggest is appropriate in the book, is in fact very good. I would just add, if you will, the concept of physical activity and stress management and sleep as keys to those as well, and I know you would too. But we are facing a true epidemic of obesity, and we have failed in culture and even with the increased costs of food and taxing of food, et cetera, to be able to get control of it in a large group of people. And our hope is that whether it is the GLP and GIPs or something else, that we are able to help people to adopt food regimens that are much healthier than we now have in the United States. And so how do we get the behavior change in the large percent of populations? Because we have seen that when we talk about disability in the future versus the joys of a Snicker bar now, that many opt for the joys of the Snicker bar now and don't have the capacity to delaying gratification.
Yeah, and I mean, that's always going to be a critical issue, but I think the first thing we have to do is get the story correct, what we're telling them. And as you know from my previous books, should we be trying to get people, particularly struggling with their weight, should we be trying to get people to eat less and exercise more? Or should we be trying to get them to avoid, again, the carbohydrate content of the diet, which is the argument in the whole series of, we call them fad diet books, but they can go back to 1825 in the most famous book ever written about food called The Physiology of Taste by a Frenchman. The argument being you don't have to eat less. It's just that the reasons those of us who fatten easily do so is because of the way our bodies respond to the carbohydrate content of the diet. I try and, with diabetes, it's an easier argument to make for type 2 diabetes because it's so clearly a problem with metabolizing the carbohydrates that we don't have to really argue about which macronutrients that need to be restricted, or we could just have to decide, is it worth telling people and counseling them? And again, what I argue is we know now over the last 20 years of clinical trials that a diet in which you, in effect, abstain from eating an entire food group is conceivably one of the healthiest diets imaginable. There was just a big article on the NPR website yesterday about people now using these ketogenic diets are called for the treatment of bipolar and schizophrenia disorder. And again, we only have anecdotal evidence in small clinical trials, but the preliminary evidence is that this is an extremely healthy way to eat, which we didn't believe 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, we couldn't make this argument. So the first thing we have to do, and you know I've always advocated for research and even helped start a not-for-profit to fund the necessary research. It was a bit of a fiasco, but we gave it our best. We have to establish what we should be telling people in the sense of, is there a most effective way to eat to achieve and maintain a healthy weight? And is there a most effective way to eat to achieve optimal blood sugar control? And if so, this is what should be communicated to everyone with guidance on how to do it if they choose to try. You can't make people try. I have the advantage that I was a cigarette smoker for 20 years, and I know what it's like to deal with addictions and to try and quit. And one level, I tried to quit smoking every day for 20 years until eventually I succeeded, and I succeeded with the help of, in effect, nicotine gum and nicotine patches. So maybe the ideal use for GLP-1 agonists is not something you take for decades, but something you take to get your weight and cravings under control and then wean yourself off onto the diet that maximizes your ability to maintain a healthy weight. We have to, you and I and everyone else has to agree on what that diet is if there is one dietary approach.
Amen on that. The book, and you can tell how well researched it is Rethinking Diabetes, What Science Reveals About Diet, Insulin, and Successful Treatments by Gary Tobbs. Gary Tobbs' website where you can find out more about his other books, such as Why We Get Fat and Good Calories, Bad Calories, is at GaryTobbs.com. I'm looking forward to reading his Substack, Unsettled Science. I should say that I have a Substack called The Longevity Blog, or it's under Michael F. Roizen, roizen.com/Substack. So feel free to look at both of our Substacks, but I am looking forward to reading Gary's well-researched book, and you can tell how superb Gary's thinking is. We, as usual, are brought to you by two websites and product makers that have that type of research. And let me just talk to you about Life's First Naturals. Go to their website, see their randomized double-blind controlled trials on why bovine colostrum may be good if you have to take a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, even aspirin, or if you do a lot of exercise, or even if all you're doing is trying to prevent an upper respiratory infection. That is lifesfirstnaturals.com, bovine colostrum. Gary, thank you very much. But most importantly, thank you, our people who have downloaded us. You're the ones we do this for. This is a really provocative and outstanding book, Rethinking Diabetes.